2. All our fellows believed that Shatov was going to betray them, but they also believed that Pyotr Stepanovich was playing with them like pawns. And yet they knew, too, that in any case they would all meet on the spot next day, and that Shatov's fate was sealed. They suddenly felt like flies caught in a web by a huge spider. They were furious, but they were trembling with terror. Pyotr Stepanovich, of course, had treated them badly. It might all have gone off far more harmoniously and easily if he had taken the trouble to embellish the facts ever so little. Instead of putting the facts in a decorous light as an exploit worthy of ancient Rome or something of the sort, he simply appealed to their animal fears and laid stress on the danger to their own skins, which was simply insulting. Of course, there was a struggle for existence in everything, and there was no other principle in nature. They all knew that. But still. But Pyotr Stepanovich had no time to trot out the Romans. He was completely thrown out of his reckoning. Stavrogin's flight had astounded and crushed him. It was a lie when he had said that Stavrogin had seen the vice-governor. What worried Pyotr Stepanovich was that Stavrogin had gone off without seeing anyone, even his mother, and it was certainly strange that he had been allowed to leave without hindrance. The authorities were called to account for it afterwards. Pyotr Stepanovich had been making inquiries all day, but so far had found out nothing, and he had never been so upset. And how could he? How could he give up Stavrogin all at once like this? That was why he could not be very tender with the quintet. Besides, they tied his hands. He had already decided to gallop after Stavrogin at once, and meanwhile he was detained by Shatov. He had to cement the quintet together once and for all in case of emergency. Pity to waste them, they might be of use. That, I imagine, was his way of reasoning. As for Shatov, Pyotr Stepanovich was firmly convinced that he would betray them. All that he had told the others about it was a lie. He had never seen the document nor heard of it, but he thought it as certain as that 2 × 2 = 4. It seemed to him that what had happened, the death of Liza, the death of Maria Timofievna, would be too much for Shatov, and that he would make up his mind at once. Who knows? Perhaps he had grounds for supposing it. It is known, too, that he hated Shatov personally. There had at some time been a quarrel between them, and Pyotr Stepanovich never forgave an offence. I am convinced, indeed, that this was his leading motive. We have narrow brick pavements in our town, and in some streets only raised wooden planks instead of a pavement. Pyotr Stepanovich walked in the middle of the pavement, taking up the whole of it, utterly regardless of Liputin, who had no room to walk beside him, and so had to hurry a step behind or run in the muddy road if he wanted to speak to him. Pyotr Stepanovich suddenly remembered how he had lately splashed through the mud to keep pace with Stavrogin, who had walked, as he was doing now, taking up the whole pavement. He recalled the whole scene, and rage choked him. But Liputin, too, was choking with resentment. Pyotr Stepanovich might treat the others as he liked, but him? Why, he knew more than all the rest, was in closer touch with the work and taking more intimate part in it than anyone. And hitherto his services had been continual, though indirect. Oh, he knew that even now Pyotr Stepanovich might ruin him if it came to the worst, but he had long hated Pyotr Stepanovich, and not because he was a danger, but because of his overbearing manner. Now, when he had to make up his mind to such a deed, he raged inwardly more than all the rest put together. Alas, he knew that next day, like a slave, he would be the first on the spot and would bring the others, and if he could somehow have murdered Pyotr Stepanovich before the morrow without ruining himself, of course, he would certainly have murdered him. Absorbed in his sensations, he trudged dejectedly after his tormentor, who seemed to have forgotten his existence, though he gave him a rude and careless shove with his elbow now and again. Suddenly, Pyotr Stepanovich halted in one of the principal thoroughfares and went into a restaurant.
"What are you doing?" cried Liputin, boiling over. "This is a restaurant.
I want a beefsteak." Upon my word, it is always full of people. What if it is? But we shall be late. It's 10 o'clock already. You can't be too late to go there. But I shall be late. They are expecting me back. Well, let them. But it would be stupid of you to go to them. With all your bobbery, I've had no dinner, and the later you go to Kirillov's, the more sure you are to find him. Pyotr Stepanovich went to a room apart. Liputin sat in an easy chair on one side, angry and resentful, and watched him eating. Half an hour and more passed. Pyotr Stepanovich did not hurry himself. He ate with relish, rang the bell, asked for a different kind of mustard, then for beer, without saying a word to Liputin. He was pondering deeply. He was capable of doing two things at once, eating with relish and pondering deeply. Liputin loathed him so intensely at last that he could not tear himself away. It was like a nervous obsession. He counted every morsel of beefsteak that Pyotr Stepanovich put into his mouth. He loathed him for the way he opened it, for the way he chewed, for the way he smacked his lips over the fat morsels. He loathed the steak itself. At last, things began to swim before his eyes. He began to feel slightly giddy. He felt hot and cold run down his spine by turns. "You are doing nothing. Read that," said Pyotr Stepanovich suddenly, throwing him a sheet of paper. Liputin went nearer to the candle. The paper was closely covered with bad handwriting, with corrections in every line. By the time he had mastered it, Pyotr Stepanovich had paid his bill and was ready to go. When they were on the pavement, Liputin handed him back the paper. "Keep it. I'll tell you afterwards. What do you say to it, though?" Liputin shuddered all over. "In my opinion, such a manifesto is nothing but a ridiculous absurdity." His anger broke out. He felt as though he were being caught up and carried along. "If we decide to distribute such manifestos," he said, quivering all over, "we'll make ourselves contemptible by our stupidity and incompetence." "I think differently," said Pyotr Stepanovich, walking on resolutely. "So do I. Surely it isn't your work. That's not your business. I think, too, that doggerel and noble personality is the most utter trash possible, and it couldn't have been written by Herzen. You are talking nonsense. It's a good poem." "I'm surprised, too, for instance," said Liputin, still dashing along with desperate leaps, "that it is suggested that we should act so as to bring everything to the ground. It's natural in Europe to wish to destroy everything because there's a proletariat there. But we are only amateurs here, and in my opinion are only showing off." "I thought you were a Fourierist." "Fourier says something quite different, quite different." "I know, it's nonsense." "No, Fourier isn't nonsense. Excuse me, I can't believe that there will be a rising in May." Liputin positively unbuttoned his coat. He was so hot. "Well, that's enough. But now, that I mayn't forget it," said Pyotr Stepanovich, passing with extraordinary coolness to another subject, "you will have to print this manifesto with your own hands. We're going to dig up Shatov's printing press, and you will take it tomorrow. As quickly as possible, you must print as many copies as you can, and then distribute them all the winter. The means will be provided. You must do as many copies as possible, for you'll be asked for them from other places." "No. Excuse me. I can't undertake such a—" "I decline. You'll take it all the same. I am acting on the instructions of the Central Committee, and you are bound to obey." "And I consider that our centres abroad have forgotten what Russia is like and have lost all touch, and that's why they talk such nonsense. I even think that instead of many hundreds of quintets in Russia, we are the only one that exists, and there is no network at all," Liputin gasped finally. "The more contemptible of you, then, to run after the cause without believing in it. And you are running after me now like a mean little cur." "No, I'm not. We have a full right to break off and found a new society." "Fool!" Pyotr Stepanovich boomed at him threateningly all of a sudden with flashing eyes. They stood facing one another for some time. Pyotr Stepanovich turned and pursued his way confidently. The idea flashed through Liputin's mind. "Turn and go back. If I don't turn now, I shall never go back." He pondered this for 10 steps, but at the 11th, a new and desperate idea flashed into his mind. He did not turn and did not go back. They were approaching Filipov's house, but before reaching it, they turned down a side street, or, to be more accurate, an inconspicuous path under a fence, so that, for some time, they had to walk along a steep slope above a ditch where they could not keep their footing without holding the fence. At a dark corner in the slanting fence, Pyotr Stepanovich took out a plank, leaving a gap through which he promptly scrambled. Liputin was surprised, but he crawled through after him. Then they replaced the plank after them. This was the secret way by which Fedka used to visit Kirillov. "Shatov mustn't know that we are here," Pyotr Stepanovich whispered sternly to Liputin.